behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benson.
And I am Ben Bolin.
Ben, today's topic comes to us from a book, and it's a book that you gave me as a gift. And this is strange, listener. You may not know this, but Ben gives out gifts on his birthday to other people.
Yeah, it's true. It's my way of saying thank you to everybody who has been my friend over the years, stuff like that. And also, you know, I'll be honest, it makes it feel like a celebration.
Well, let me tell you, I really appreciate this. You gave me a book, and it's called Strange But True Tales of Car Collecting, and it's by Keith Martin. Mm-hmm. And our topic today comes from this book, as we'll get into in just a minute. But, you know, I've heard of people doing this before, but I've never known anybody who actually gives away gifts on their birthday. So that's very thoughtful of you. Thank you.
Oh, hey, man. Thank you.
I appreciate it, and our listeners can thank you for it, too, because, you know, we ended up with some great topics out of this book. And we're going to have at least a couple coming up soon. And I know that there's a lot more information in here that we want to get to. So let's dig right into today's topic, which is a very strange tale of a used car deal.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's
very, it's an understatement.
it's a story of a used car deal and so much more. Now we want to go ahead and at the top say, that this gets kind of complicated. So this is, this might have a little bit of meandering.
It will. And I'll tell you, there's, as usual, you know, when you start digging into this stuff, you know, we find that, you know, the story itself is really interesting. All the stuff surrounding this story is even more interesting. And that leads off in different directions as well. So I'm going to try my best. You'll hear some paper shuffling going on for sure. There's a lot of characters involved in this that, that we'll get to, you know, we'll introduce them as we go along and we'll try to. But there's some bizarre twists at the end as well.
Yeah, yeah. Let's, you know what, Scott? Let's just go ahead and start with, well, let's just start with Bugatti.
Sure.
Just the Bugatti company.
Oh, why not? Let's start with the Bugatti company. So, okay, the Bugatti company founded in, 1909?
Mm-hmm.
Ettore Bugatti. How do you like that?
That was great.
Yeah, not bad. I'm not going to do that again. It's just a Bugatti.
Oh, that was good.
Maybe I will. We'll see how it goes. But I like to try to take our listeners there, Ben. I really do with my accent, you know?
Yeah.
This is probably one of the very few French words that I'll be able to pronounce as we go through this, because there's a lot of French that happens in this episode. Now, all right. As you know, Bugatti was the purveyor of, is that the right word? Purveyor of fine automobiles.
Right. High-end luxury vehicles. Yeah. The rides of sultans and kings.
High performance automobiles. And their competition at the time, just to give you an idea, and I'm sure most people understand this, but the competition at the time was Bentley. Mm-hmm. So, and that's funny. There's kind of a little bit of a rivalry, I guess, going between, you know, the Bugatti founder and the Bentley mark, because he said, I believe he said at one point, that he thought his competition's vehicles were a lot like fast trucks, because of course Bentley focused on durability rather than speed necessarily. Even though they were fast, Bugatti's main focus was speed and design. So he's focused on design and beauty, of course. And you know, as far as design goes, the engine blocks themselves were hand scraped. So that they didn't have to have any gaskets when they put them together.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I mean, you'd be able to mate metal to metal surfaces with no gaskets and they would still be operational, still tight.
I mean, honestly, I'm a little bit, I still kind of think it's sorcery.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't want to sound too old fashioned.
I mean, that's all done by hand. Of course, no machines. But, you know, they did use machining for some of the exterior surfaces of the engine, which is remarkable as well, because they had these really kind of intricate designs carved into them via milling, right?
Yeah.
So unusual. The other thing is that they used safety wires that were threaded through all these fasteners, and it was kind of like intricately laced patterns that would be laid out across the whole vehicle. That's an old racer's trick, and they still do that. I mean, they still safety lace these things with wire, so that, you know, if a fastener comes loose, it doesn't end up on the track.
Right.
But they did that right from the factory with Bugatti. The springs were not springs that would, you know, as the normal cars of the day would have. They weren't bolted to the axle. They were cast in a way that, or forged in a way that the springs were allowed to pass through the axle, which he thought was a much more elegant way of solving that problem.
So we're seeing this emphasis on aesthetic as well as performance, and it's more and more a rolling work of art.
Exactly right. Bugatti was something, even at the time, now it's heralded as being, maybe the ultimate collector's car,
right.
These are,
yeah.
In a lot of circles, I guess.
Well, yeah, just for some perspective, 1936 type 57 SC Atlantic Coupe sold in 2010, Scott, for over $28
million. $28 million for a single vehicle. Now, that's that's pretty remarkable. We're talking about, like the Concours level restoration on something like that. It's not the...
Right.
The Driven or the Barn Find, or maybe it is a Barn Find. Who knows? Sometimes those are the ones that go for the more money, the ones that are dirty and beaten up a bit.
Yeah,
show the patina, right? But so $28 million for one, which makes this whole thing that we're going to talk about today kind of puts it all in perspective, right?
I mean, even more remarkable.
I mean, when one vehicle can be worth nearly $30 million, let's just say that, it's on the low end and it's worth $10 million.
Right.
One Bugatti. The deal that we're going to talk about today really does put all that in perspective.
Yes, the deal we're talking about today is an international deal in 1964, not just for one Bugatti, Scott, not just for 10, but for 30 Bugattis.
Yeah.
A Swiss industrialist living in France made a deal with a guy in Illinois to buy 30 Bugattis.
So that's right. I mean, he took the whole collection at one time, 30 vehicles he bought at one time, in one place, but for a remarkable price. I mean, it's an extremely low price, even for 1964.
$85,000.
Yeah, $85,000. And you think, well, that still sounds like a lot of money, right? It's $85,000. That converts to, in 2014, Ben, $652,174.84. Now, that's still a lot of money right now, but when you think about this, 30 Bugattis. Now, even at the time, that was an outstanding deal, but the owner of these cars, Ben, and we'll get to him too, I promise,
yeah,
he's another character.
Yeah.
He was only asking $105,000 for the whole collection. That's what he wanted to get out of the deal. Now, of course, the guy that talked him down, Fritz Schlumpf, I think is that how you say it?
Yeah, Schlumpf. It's like Schlumpf.
Schlumpf, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay, that's going to be a tough one to say, right? Maybe I'll call him Fritz from now on.
Yeah, let's get on a first name basis with him.
Well, Fritz, he talked him down to $85,000, but I think his initial offer was something like $70,000. And we're going to get to the details of all this as we go. But man, these guys are—they're making this pretty big deal. It was an international deal, as you mentioned, but it was one that garnered international attention as well, because it's not often that that a prize collection of Bugattis goes across the pond.
Right, and let's get into a little bit of their backgrounds, these men, because they're very different.
Oh, they're extremely different, and there's more than one Schlumpf brother that we need to talk about. There's two of them. I just mentioned the brothers.
We talked about Fritz. We also need to talk about Hans.
Yeah, Fritz and Hans. Now, these guys, boy, Ben, I'll tell you, they're not good guys.
This is weird.
They're really not. Now, one does treat the employees better than the other one, and I'll tell you about that in just a second, like in just 1 minute, but overall, I mean, the character of these guys is not something you would aspire to be. I mean, they're not great guys, as you'll find out as the story progresses here.
Right. So, yes, the Schlumpfs, they are technically speaking Swiss citizens. They're born in Italy. They live with their mom. After she's widowed, the whole family moves to Alsace, France. The two brothers apparently had a little bit of an obsession with their mother. Just to throw that in.
Maybe a little something going on, a little...
Everybody loves their parents, but there was a little bit of weirdness.
Okay, got it. Yeah, some mommy issues.
Yeah, maybe that's the best way to say it. In 1935, they founded a company that would produce spun woolen products. And during the Nazi invasion of France, they're expanding their business. And they start to become very, very wealthy, especially after World War II.
Yeah, wealthy enough that the Fritz, who loved cars right from the very beginning, they're in the textile business, they're doing well. He's finally able to secure, I guess, a vehicle that he's always wanted to have, and that was a Bugatti, because that Alsace region that you mentioned, that is the HQ for Bugatti. So likely he was seeing all these cars being churned out of the factory. And, he wanted one of these since he was very, very young, and was finally able to get one. So he bought a Bugatti Type 35B just before the Nazi invasion of France.
Right. He also began expanding this Bugatti collection. You know what? With the help of Hans as well, they collectively began expanding this collection. The 30 Bugattis they wanted to buy in 64 were not the first batch of Bugattis they had purchased.
No, exactly right. And you know what? When we get to the 1960s, because we're still a little bit prior to this, right? We're still in the wartime, I guess, and I want to mention the way that these brothers treated their employees.
Yeah, it is important.
It was dramatically different in the way that they treated them. Now, again, overall, they're both not great characters, as we'll find out as we go through this whole story. But they did manage people in extremely different ways. Now, Fritz, I guess, this is strange once you get to the end of the story, but you'll find out that Fritz was probably, you know, the more generous of the brothers, I guess. He was the nicer of the two. He was generous to workers. He often gave them, you know, allowed them to take trips or provided them with trips. He installed an employee theater. He even also would drive expectant mothers to the hospital in his own personal car. So that's the kind of guy he was. He was just a nice, I guess, caring boss, right? You know, he was personable.
He knew that happy workers make better workers.
Exactly right. He was personable, and his brother Hans was anything but that. Now, this guy was the kind of cold brother. He was he's a former banker. He paid the mill workers very poorly. He would dock them 15 minutes off their pay if they were late, or if they signed out a minute or two early, he would do the same thing. He would dock them 15 minutes of pay.
Yeah.
And he often would not pay bonuses or incremental raises like he was supposed to. So this is out of the two of them, he treated the workers on the bad side, I guess, versus the two, you know, compared to the two of them, I suppose.
Right. And, they were single-minded. They were driven. Their business was still expanding, as was their car collection.
Exactly right. And so we get, you know, we're into the mid-1950s, let's say.
Okay.
And we're just past the war, and what's going on is, you know, that times are tough in France, of course.
All around,
everywhere, all over Europe. And a lot of people, though, are at this point deciding that they do want a new car because they're at the point where, you know, it's possible. Because we're talking the mid-1950s, not right out of the war. So it's just after. And some of these new designs are coming out, and people are deciding that they want to get rid of some of these classic 1920s and 1930s cars. They don't really hold as much value as they did before. You know, they were a brand new car at the time. People want to get rid of them. And, of course, they're not to the point yet where they're really collectible or antique or anything like that.
Right.
So they're taking advantage of this, and they start buying up all the cars that they can, and not just Bugattis, because Bugattis were their main focus, as we'll find out.
Right.
But they start buying up cars of all makes and models, and they're buying them in secret.
Ah, I'm so glad you said that. Who doesn't love a good secret, except, of course, the people who are having secrets kept from them? They had what became known as the Schlumpf obsession, a single-mindedness that applied to both their issues with their mother and their top-secret car collection. Scott, over their years, they acquired 400 items. And they're called items because it would be vehicles, chassis, and engines. And they eventually, as we'll find, converted a wing of one of their spinning mills into a shop to maintain and restore these vehicles. Up to, and we're not sure how many, but up to 40 carpenters and saddlers and master mechanics were working on this. But the thing was, they were under an ironclad confidentiality agreement.
Yeah, they made them sign a confidentiality agreement that would state that they're not to talk about anything that happens in the mill at any time. Mm-hmm. And what's happening, that they're gathering this collection, this growing collection. And so they had, here's the deal, they had four mills to begin with that were operational with employees, and they're turning out woolen products, right? And the textile industry. They bought the Mulhouse property, which also contained the mill, you know, the Mulhouse mill.
Yeah.
Which was going to be their museum. They knew this right from the very beginning. It was never intended to be a functional woolen mill, even though that's what it was in the past. But, they bought it as that. And of course, you know, they didn't raise any eyebrows doing that because they're doing well. They're making a lot of money. And what was going on, though, is this is where they were secretly hoarding away all of these cars that they bought. I mean, this is a massive, massive place. Huge. Like, I think I saw, 200,000 square meters is the floor space in this thing. It's enormous.
Right.
You measure that in acres when you talk about it in size.
Oh, yeah. It's 19,000 square meters, 200,000 square feet.
It's gigantic. It's a huge place. Now, of course, it's all broken up, you know, different rooms and everything, but they eventually get rid of all those walls and they support it so that it's one giant showroom.
Right, with these, I guess, units of different cars and the walkways between them on these, you know, iconic red tile walkways with names like Schlumpf Avenue and, you know, Bugatti Way.
Yeah, something that is a little clever, the way that they can figure out where they are, because this place is so big, they had to have kind of a grid system laid out so they could, you know, determine where certain vehicles go and, you know, how to get to different places. You know, it's something you have to do when you get that big, I suppose. You have to organize the exhibit. And they were restoring these cars, as we said, in secrecy in the shop in that part of the museum, or the, I say museum now, but it was a mill at the time.
Right.
In that part of the mill that, they still have that in the museum that exists today.
And they especially don't want other employees to find out about these excesses. So let's go ahead and bracket the adventures of the strange single-minded Schlumpf brothers for now, and follow a very important letter, telephone call across the Atlantic, where it reaches, you know, of course, John W. Shakespeare.
Sure. And you know what? Prior to this, just before we get to this, during the summer of 1960, so we're talking about 2 years before this letter that you're talking about went across, during the summer of 1960, they had acquired 10 Bugattis, including two Type 57s and one Type 46 5-liter model. And they also found, so, you know, I mentioned they had other makes and models too, right? They also found three Rolls Royces, two Hispano Suizes.
Oh, here's my favorite.
And a Tatra. Yeah, unusual, huh?
Yeah.
Strange that they had that, right? Now, by the end of summer in 1960, they already had the collection grown to 40 cars. Now, 40 cars doesn't sound like a huge collection or anything. It's big.
Yeah.
But wait till you hear the numbers that we get to at the end of this podcast.
It's a lot of wampum.
It's incredible. It is. A lot of wampum for that. So, all right. In addition to that, they're also buying up racing cars.
Sure.
Ferrari sold them one. I think Mercedes. Now, this is weird. The companies, the factories are selling them like
direct.
Like the old cars, direct. Like, and this is weird. They're selling them old cars, spare parts from their collections. Mercedes was doing this. Ferrari was doing this. Gordini was doing this. I mean, they're selling them like 10 old racing cars in one sale. So this guy is gathering, or these guys, I should say, are gathering this amazing amount of vehicles and racing cars. They're just regular motoring cars.
Oh, they're getting a little crazy because I guess I was being a little bit, too liberal with the poetic license there. Here's what starts happening. Fritz sends out a boilerplate letter to all the Bugatti owners on the Bugatti Club register and says, I will buy all of your cars.
All of your cars.
That's a little crazy.
That is a little crazy. And I'm sure that a lot of them raised their eyebrows when they saw this and thought, what's up? Because, you know, people are pretty protective about stuff like this. They don't want the entire collection to go to one person or one place.
Right.
And a lot of people like it when, you know, there's, these cars are in the hands of enthusiasts.
Yeah. He's like a car hoarder.
That's great, man. You know, I'm glad you said that. He's like a car hoarder. I mean, this guy is just, you know, the more he can get, the better. And he doesn't even know what he's going to do. He has no real use for them other than to display them. I mean, that's his grand vision, is that he's going to display them. So he's got this idea early on and, you know, probably in the mid-1950s, that he wants to create this museum that's going to be of a grand scale, and it's going to feature his favorite mark, which is Bugatti, but it's also going to have hundreds of other makes and models that are restored to museum condition.
And now let me say, I know it sounds like we're giving this guy a hard time, but one huge advantage of this kind of single-minded obsession, this drive that I respect, is that that kind of tenacity makes people successful. Scott, in 1962, he had bought nearly 50 Bugattis, right?
In 1962. Yeah, that's amazing. Like, and that's when he started. Now, that's 50 cars from different places, you know, all over the place. He's amassing them, right? So not 50 in one shot or anything like that, but it takes a lot of work to put together 50 cars, you know, car
individual deals.
Exactly, right, for cars of this caliber as well. And we're talking about racing Bugattis, you know, I guess we'll just call them street Bugattis for lack of a better way to say it. But, you know, the cars that you would just drive around on your estate or something like that, right? Around town in London, maybe.
Yeah. And then in the spring of 63, something really impressive happens.
Yeah. He acquired 18 of Bugatti's personal cars. So the ones that, you know, Bugatti himself drove or used on the, you know, at the headquarters, because, you know, that company's going through some hard times, I guess starting in the, when is it, like mid-1950s, I think, you know, the old man's gone. He's passed away at that point. And, you know, the company's on a downward slide, but he's still has all these personal cars that are available. And Fritz knows this. And of course, he goes for all 18 of them.
Crazy stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's, and that, those have got a history too, which is really nice. I mean, so you say like, these are owned by the owner of the company.
Like the Coup Napoleon. And, there are so many historical masterpieces at this point in the Schlumpf collection, which is still, again, secret because he's not being exactly like he's not saying I'm building an empire of museums, you know?
Yeah. And all the time, you know, that we're talking about right now between 1962 and 1963, 64, there's this correspondence that's going on between, between Fritz Schlumpf and John Shakespeare.
Ah, yes, because collector John Shakespeare of Centralia, Illinois says, you know, I can give you this collection, 30 Bugattis for, what do we say, Scott, 105,000?
Yeah, 105,000.
Let's talk a little bit about John before we move on. His father was William Shakespeare, not the one you're thinking about.
unless you're a fisherman.
Right, unless you're a fisherman, then you are correct. You were thinking of the inventor of the level winding fishing reel. He earned, let's see, what we already said wampum. He earned mountains of moolah off this invention.
Mm-hmm, that's exactly right. And he made a boatload of money on other types of fishing tackle as well. I think he even introduced fiberglass rods and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, I found out, Ben, that it wasn't just that. I think he also had other patents as well. I want to say that he held patents on camera equipment and even a carburetor at one point. So, you know, his dad, you know, William Shakespeare was an inventor. And of course, this guy is born with a silver spoon in his mouth. You know, he's very wealthy right from the very beginning.
He's sent to Harvard and stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. But he wasn't just kind of this, this millionaire playboy type guy. He also had some business interests.
Yeah, he had an import car dealership.
Exactly right. Yeah, I think he opened up, what was it, the name of that place? It was,
He eventually named it Shakespeare Motors.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And it housed things like Ferraris and Porsches, and which he also raced on the weekends.
Right. Yeah. He was not, just idle with this. He was often described as a sportsman because he would race sports cars. He was also a skier and a skydiver.
He's a gentleman racer. Now, the thing is I heard that he had this collection that, of course, you know, he was bitten by the Bugatti bug as well, right? So he obviously had this big collection. He had 30 Bugattis of all different types and makes and models and conditions. And in fact, he even had one. You know, I'm going to mention this one that I think we really need to talk about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking
about. Tell you what, let me back up for just 1 second because I do want to say that the reason that he's getting rid of all these, you know, we need to lay this out right now.
Oh, that's a good point.
The reason they were getting rid of these is he said he was falling out of shape, you know, like physical shape, because the time that was involved in keeping these cars in operational condition. And you said that he's like a water skier and a skydiver. And
right.
He's an active guy. He likes to do things, right? But he finds himself more and more tied to the shop or, you know, dealing with just handling the day-to-day stuff that goes with owning cars like this. You know, the maintenance and all the other drudgery, I guess, that goes with owning 30 Bugattis, if there is drudgery in owning 30 Bugattis, Ben.
Yeah, right.
But anyways, he decides that, you know, he's falling out of physical condition, you know, physical shape, and it's time for them to go. So he puts this, you know, just, I guess, abstract, maybe not so abstract price on these things of $105,000. I guess that's exactly what he had paid for all of them combined.
Yeah, it was like he was breaking even.
Yeah, because he got a great deal on some of these. And the one in particular that everybody points to is a Type 41 Royale Park Ward limousine.
Only six were made. The chassis alone sells for around $30,000 in 1927.
Yeah, now this is the 1960s when he's getting it, right?
Right, and there's something very, very important about this.
Oh, I'm sorry, 1956 when he bought it.
Oh, yeah, okay, right. So mid-50s, there's something very, very important and unique about the Royale.
What's that?
It's, oddly enough, a prize symbol on the radiator cap.
Mm-hmm.
A silver elephant sculpted by Rembrandt Bugatti, the brother of the founder of Bugatti, Ettore.
Hmm, interesting. All right. So there's that. Mm-hmm. There's also just there's only six of these things in the entire world, right? That's another thing.
So how much do you get it for?
he paid $10,000 in 1956. Now, that's still a lot of money back then, right? I understand that, but yeah. It's a heck of a deal.
Yes, sir.
I mean, really a great deal. And it's a prize car, even back then, of course. You know, everybody knew that this thing was worth a lot of money. This is just a guy that just wants to get rid of his collection. He's just done with it. You know, he's had enough. And I know that people can probably sympathize with this a bit, that, you know, like, you've got a project car or whatever, and you decide at some point you're just done, and you're like, I'm just going to take a fair offer for it and be done with it. I'm not going to try to get, you know, squeeze any more money out of it, get, you know, everything that I possibly can. It's just, I want to be done with it. I want to move on to something else. And yeah. That's exactly what he was doing. So once he starts his correspondence with Fritz, you know, things are not quite smooth. I mean, it's a little bit rocky because they get a little bit testy with each other, right?
Yeah, they have about a year of wrangling, and both of them, let's think about this, both of them are quite well off. Both of them are probably used to being treated like a king in a lot of ways, you mm-hmm. know. Both of them probably don't hear the word no very often.
And they're dealing with a liaison. So there's somebody in between them that is making, you know, these connections. It's not like they're talking directly to the other person. And I think that factors into this a little bit. It's a little easier to be more abrupt with somebody in between.
With an intermediary. Yeah. Bob Shaw of Wheaton, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. That's one. And there was another one, a Bugatti historian. His name was Hugh Conway. And so between the two of them, they were dealing with Shakespeare and Schlumpf, and they finally, I think it was, again, after how long?
It's about a year.
About a year of this correspondence back and forth. Finally, they got the two of these guys together on a price, and I think that it took a lot of wrangling because they had gone out to inspect the cars because Fritz couldn't make the trip himself. He was busy with his milling, you know, his woolen mill, and he was unable to make the trip to do this. He was just a busy guy. So he sent, you know, they both agreed, the seller and the buyer chose Shaw to inspect the entirety of Shakespeare's collection in 1963 and to see what it was really worth. You know, what's there, what it's worth, because, you know, what the seller tells you and what's really there is maybe two different things.
That's very smart. So there's some interesting contrast to look at here. Fritz Schlumpf originally says he'll only pay 70 grand if the cars are impeccable. And then, you know, Shaw comes back and reports along with Conway that most of Shakespeare's Bugattis are parked on a dirt floor in a building with broken windows, a leaky roof, a mini in a state of disassembly, haven't run for more than a year. In response, Fritz, at some point in these negotiations, raises his price to $85,000.
So isn't this funny?
Yeah, because he wants him so bad.
So, okay, here's the thing. So, you know, Shakespeare wants $105,000, which is a bargain to begin with. I mean,
right.
It really, truly is.
It sure is. It's a fire sale.
So Fritz offers him about two-thirds of that, right? Which I guess is a smart move, right? But he says they have to be impeccable for that price, which, that's pretty hard line to take.
They're not.
They're definitely not. They're in, you know, some of them aren't even running. You know, five of them, I think, were disassembled at the time.
Yeah, for restoration, right?
Exactly right. So, you know, there's pieces and parts all over the place. And one of the biggest problems is that there's a crack in the Royale's huge straight eight engine block. And Schlumpf returns with, you know, he notifies Schlumpf of this.
Yeah.
Because he finds it a long way. He didn't know it was there even, honestly. And Schlumpf writes back and says, why don't you just have somebody arc weld that shut, you know, and we'll just make the deal happen no matter what.
And at one point, Shakespeare said, you know, I could just sell these, bring up the collection.
Yeah.
And then Fritz loses his mind and accuses the guy of, well, that's not fair to say loses his mind.
But, you know, he did.
It seems very extreme because he accuses Shakespeare of extortion and threatens to sue him.
Right. He threatens to bring legal action through a variety of sources. So there's obviously some big tension here, even towards the end of this whole deal. And finally, I mean, finally, I don't know, again, this is after, well, they first contacted each other in 1962. This is 1964 before all this really happens, but they finally come to terms and the $85,000 stands as the deal. And this is where the whole train load of Bugattis, legend comes about, because it's true. It really did happen.
Yeah, this is not a myth. Let me laundry list just the route they agreed on real quick. Is that cool?
Sure.
Okay, so Shakespeare chose the Southern Railway system, and this would transport the Bugattis to New Orleans for their ocean travel to Le Havre, France. Boy, I butchered that one, huh, buddy?
That's close enough.
And then they also outlined the routes that they would take there. They had to consider, because after they get to France, they have to be trucked 430 miles.
Yeah, it's a long trip.
So they had to figure out the loading order for these cars. As you know, Scott, and as you know, listeners, these Bugattis vary greatly.
Yeah, in size, shape, weight, everything. I mean, in condition, just able to make the trip at all, really. Some of them were in pretty poor condition. I think that's part of the delay in this was that, Shakespeare was getting the cars ready for delivery. He had to make sure that all of them had wheels. All of them were able to be steered once they were on. So they all had to have steering wheels, which some of them didn't at the time when they were inspected. All the extra stuff, all the engine blocks and everything that goes along with these cars had to be, it had to be well thought out before they could ship them. And that's the other thing, Ben, that $85,000 included all the shipping that you're talking about. So it included the train ride. It included being loaded onto a freighter in New Orleans. It included,
I would say, no deal. Shipping is on you.
I mean, how long do you think it took them to be shipped, via this freighter, a Dutch freighter from New Orleans here in the United States over to France? How long do you think that took? Like, I mean, probably took a week. Then there's also, the truck transportation on the other end. I mean, it's an enormous cost, and all of that was wrapped into that $85,000 that he paid.
So we do know that on March 30th, 1964, there really was a trainload of Bugattis heading down toward New Orleans, and they had to be careful. They started loading them at 8:30 in the morning at Shakespeare's shop, and they weren't done until 7 p.m., which to me is the least you could expect. I would be mortified if people were hurrying when they were stacking this.
Yeah.
So the legend is true, but that's not the entire story. Before we tell you the rest of the story, we have a quick little word from our sponsors this episode.
Our sponsors?
Yeah, us.
Us? We're our own sponsors?
We're our own sponsors, because we have a video series coming out that we wanted to mention to you guys.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the video series that we shot at the High Museum of Art here in Atlanta.
Yep.
The Dream Car Exhibit. And Ben, that may just be the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, listeners, it's up to you. Let us know if you like the video stuff. Now, I'll say, we get our ugly mugs in a museum. We were classing up the place. I'm kidding. But we do hope to be able to do more of these projects, and we would love to hear recommendations from you guys about the kind of stuff that you would like to see us travel for in the future.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I mean, some local stuff. Who knows? Maybe we can get a little travel budget out of this and travel to some places and go see some things and do some fun things, with it. But the videos are a lot of fun to do, and hopefully you like them as well. So if you go to the How Stuff Works YouTube channel, and you have to scroll down a little bit, I guess, now at this point to see our videos, but they're there, and give us some feedback. Tell us what you think.
Yeah, we have more stuff coming out over the next few weeks.
Exactly right.
And now we are back to the legendary Bugatti journey. So we said that they arrive after, what, a 400-something mile drive?
A truck ride, yeah. That's the smallest leg of this whole journey, really.
True. I kind of ignored those.
Well, yeah, the other stuff, but the thing is, now this is funny, Ben, and this is pretty telling, I guess, for the character that Fritz was, right? When they arrived at the Mulhouse location, there's going to be a lot of people saying, well, what's going on here? There's 30 Bugattis being unloaded and driven into that abandoned factory. What's going on? Fritz had an unusual way to greet the onlookers, the spectators, didn't he?
Yeah, he showed up with a whip just in case there would be some unscrupulous peasants trying to mess with his cars. He really was focused on this collection.
Isn't that crazy? So the trucks show up, and he's got this collection of cars, and he should be just overjoyed. Should be a happy guy, right?
Yeah.
He's got a bullwhip in his hands. He's ready to whip people that get near his vehicles there or look at his cars the wrong way, that show an unusual interest in the cars, right?
Yeah.
So he's keeping people away. And remember, he's up to this point, he's been building this collection in secrecy, right? So he's trying to keep it all secret. But how do you keep a truckload after truckload of Bugatti secret as they arrive at the museum? Maybe there's a hidden location he can unload them or something, but I don't know, Ben. I mean,
yeah,
the whole thing was publicized here in the United States fairly heavily. I mean, because,
right,
How often are you going to see 30 Bugattis on a train? And by the way, that train, and I need to mention this because I forgot to say this when we were talking about it. When they loaded them on the train, you know, from Shakespeare's property, which happened to be right next to the train tracks.
Yeah.
They put them on this train, and it was like, I think it was three big railway cars that were, you know, vehicle transport type vehicle, cars, of course, right?
Uh-huh.
And they were completely open. They were not covered. There was no protection really from the elements. There was no protection from, animals or
the eyes of strangers.
Yeah, you know, whatever. I mean, there was nothing, and they didn't put anything on the cars. They didn't wrap them in any way.
No.
The only protection that these cars had that entire trip from Illinois down to New Orleans was they wrapped the steering wheels in plastic. So I guess when they're loading and unloading them, they didn't get their greasy hands on the steering wheel.
Well, also they chained them down.
Well, they did that. But I mean, think about the way cars are shipped today with the plastic wraps and, you know, they're in covered containers and they're very, very careful about it. And here we are with 30 Bugattis being transported. More than 1,000 miles, probably, if I had to guess. I don't know the distance exactly, but 1,000 miles via open train containers.
Well, here's another thing that I think we should bring back into the picture is that all is not well in the Schlumpf Empire. By the late 1960s, the textile industry in Europe is collapsing as people, you know, tale as old as time, people are finding, or companies are finding cheaper products and cheaper operation costs in other countries. In this case, these would be Asian countries. And
you know what else was happening in the late 60s?
What's that?
They had also gathered 105 Bugattis at this point. Their collection had grown to 105. Now, that includes the 30 that he just purchased from Shakespeare.
Yeah, but they're taking money from their business, not just profits. They're taking money from their business's operation budget to buy Bugattis.
So you remember we mentioned early on that these guys are, I mean, really up to no good, right? It ends up that they're up to no good. So this obsession of theirs, this Bugatti obsession, that's more so on Fritz Hans a little bit, but he's involved, but and he's supportive. It's not his thing. Fritz is really the one that's the driving force behind this whole thing, I believe. Now the problem is that you mentioned they're taking money from the business. It wasn't just they weren't just taking
their own share of the profits.
Exactly right. They're taking money from the business that's supposed to be going towards the operation of the business, and they're using it to buy Bugattis. Now, up until this point, though, the workers don't know that.
Right. Yeah, they don't. His workers are having a tough relationship with them. You know, Hans was always kind of the bad cop, and Fritz, although he could be generous to his employees, he wasn't helping their working conditions that much. And the strikes start.
Yeah, the strikes start right around, what is it, 1976, I think?
Yeah.
Because that's when the Schlumpf brothers began having to sell their factories. You know, they had to sell off some of the assets in order to keep everything going, right?
Well, to keep their Bugatti habit going.
Well, they did, but no one knew that at the time. So they also start with some layoffs. Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets a little touchy, you know? I mean, people, when they start to lose their jobs, they start to think, well, what's going on? These guys are so incredibly wealthy. They're not showing any signs of cutting back in their own personal life.
Right. How is the company failing, but these guys are fine?
Exactly right. And so they as the layoffs progress, in 1976, there's a workers' strike. And, you know, the enraged employees, get this, Ben, they head towards the Mulhouse Mill because they think that's where, you know, their main focus is. That's where the brothers are. They're in the Mulhouse Mill. And it takes 400 police to hold back the workers who want to go in and ransack the factory out of vengeance.
And that's when they discover the hidden car collection.
Yeah, they walk in, Ben, and they find that there's 600 cars that are some, and they're laid out in almost like a museum.
Right. Districts of 10 to 20 cars each. It's got three restaurants in this place.
123 Bugattis. And, you know, they're all these crazy lamps that they have around that they've restored as well to light the museum. So, you know, that's one of the things when you see the photos of this museum, you'll notice the lamps in there. These were part of the brothers' design. They wanted to recreate a certain region in France, I guess.
So things go south very quickly.
Yeah.
The brothers declare bankruptcy. They flee back to Switzerland. You know, again, as we said, they're Swiss residents. And then, they live in a hotel permanently.
Yeah, right. They live in a hotel after coming from such, you know, amazing wealth. I'm sure they're still not doing all that bad. You know, this is the way it is. They've squirreled away some money, I'm sure. But the workers, in the meantime, have occupied the Mulhouse factory, and they continue to occupy that for several years. And what they do to regain some of the money is they say, well, there's this museum all set up here. And you remember Fritz was on the verge of opening this museum, or at least, you know, having the museum complete. I don't know if he was ever intending to have it open to the public. Maybe.
Right.
Maybe he was. But they discover this thing, and it's pretty much a turnkey museum for them. It's ready to go. So the workers decide to open it to the public for an admission fee. You can come through and look at the cars, and that's how they're going to regain some of their money.
Right. And then
they did this for 2 years.
Right. In 79, a bankruptcy liquidator said the building's closed, and they sold it to a consortium, including the city of Mulhouse, the Alsace region, the Paris Auto Show, and the Automobile Club of France. And that's where they lucked out, because eventually the museum became considered a national heritage site by the French government. So that means what's important about that, you guys, is that if it's a heritage site, it means that the collection legally cannot be exported, nor can it be dispersed.
That's right. And that happened in 1981, and they sold it to the National Automobile Museum Association. That's that consortium that you mentioned, Ben.
Yeah.
All those individual groups come together to make this one association. And that you're right about the breaking it up. That's understood. You know, that's you can't do that. So now it's considered a national
heritage.
National heritage. I call it a national treasure, really. I mean, it's an amazing collection. But the thing is, Ben, there were two reserves as well.
Okay.
And they have two different conditions, I guess, that these fall under. So, you know, reserve collections are in two different places. One, thankfully, for the collection, happened to be in the Mulhouse Museum when all this went down. And it's actually considered part of the Mulhouse collection. And they just call it the reserve collection. It's as simple as that. But this is a group of unrestored vehicles, chassis, spare parts, things like that, that the French government has recently put on display. So even unrestored, they're still on display, and it's still part of the collection.
The second reserve is the trickier one, because they were stored in these villages around Malmersbach, and they had 62 cars total. 16 of those are Bugattis. But since these never technically belonged to the Mulhouse Museum, they were not under that legal protection. The bankruptcy court seized them to cover the Schlumps' bills, and they were awarded to Schlumps' widow, because we have reached that part of the story.
Yeah, in 1999 is when this whole settlement happened. So you can see this goes on for decades. I mean, this whole battle, court battle, to settle a lawsuit that Fritz had, you know, he had filed against, you know, the French government, mm-hmm. for taking away his collection, I guess. You know, he
right.
felt that he was wronged in some way, right?
And they were also sued, both brothers, for tax evasion and convicted.
And convicted. They were tried in absentia, but they were guilty of tax evasion, and they were convicted, but they never went to jail. I mean, they never had to serve a single day in jail, but they were unable to return to France. They were unable to return to the Mulhouse collection. They were unable to really access any of their collection of their the materials that they collected over the decades. And this had to be just eating them alive. But one thing, like one minor victory that they had, was this award to Fritz's, well, eventually his widow.
Right. He passed away in 1992 at the age of 86.
Yeah. And in 1999, this lawsuit that he had filed against the French government in the 1970s was finally settled, and they gave the entire second reserve collection to Arlette, his widow. And that was, again, those 62 cars that you mentioned. 16 of those were Bugattis.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty incredible that this all happened. But she then passed away in 2008, and then that collection became available for sale again.
Yes, and while the collection got broken up, that second reserve collection from Malmersbach, there's a little bit of good news there.
Yeah, Peter Mullen of California, Oxnard, California, I think he has a museum there, right? And he bought a lot of the cars, including six of those original Shakespeare Bugattis, for his museum in Oxnard, California. So you know, some of those ended up coming back to the United States. You know, this collection was kind of subject to different rules, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we mentioned that there were 16 Bugattis. Now, I mean, I don't know how many of those went to Mullen. I mean, I know that the six were of the original Shakespeare collection, but I don't know the total count, or, you know, I don't know how to break down that whole collection really, but some of them did come back and others were just kind of scattered. But you may remember Mullen. I think he's also in charge of, or he's taken over the control of the Peterson Museum in Los Angeles, I believe, right?
Oh, that's right.
And a lot of people were concerned that he was getting rid of some classic American cars and he was bringing in some of these French Art Deco cars. But I think the case is, and I'm not entirely sure of this, but I think he's stocking his other museum with these French Art Deco cars, which we all knew was happening. But the fear is that he was going to change over the Peterson Museum to be kind of a similar thing, when really it was supposed to be about, you know, Southern California car culture. So Peter Mullen's come up in our podcast before. There's an entire podcast about that.
Yeah, so do check it out. And I've got to say, before we move on, I find this so fascinating, Scott, the level of obsession and dedication. You know, it feels like the more we research this story, it feels that at some point, Fritz Schlumpf decided not only did he like Bugattis, but he didn't want anyone else to have one.
Yeah, can I just mention some numbers before we get to this kind of like one last thing that you want to mention? Because there's an interesting twist to the whole Shakespeare angle on this, right? But overall, I mean, the whole car collection, I've got two different sets of numbers here, and I'll explain it in a second. But
okay.
But right now, if you were to go see the Schlumpf collection at the Mulhouse Museum, which is still around, you could still go to do that. It's a beautiful collection. It's amazing from the photos. I would love to go see this. I think it's the world's largest automobile museum. Is that right?
Yeah, it's huge. Visit their website.
Yeah, it's gigantic. And I think it is one of the biggest in the world, if not the biggest in the world, as far as museum goes. But they have 520 cars in the collection total. And of those 520, as I mentioned, 123 of those cars are Bugattis. Now, again, that's Fritz's obsession, as you mentioned, right? But if you consider the entire collection, including the reserves, the two reserves that we also have, now, particularly the other one, the one that ended up in Arlette's hands, remember the other 62 cars?
Yeah.
That means that the total collection of cars that these two brothers amassed that short period of time, really, was about 582 cars total.
Wow.
139 of those were Bugattis, because that, remember the other 16. So nearly 140 Bugattis. So 139 total. That, if you look at outright numbers, I looked at, Bugatti production prior to 1950, and it amounts to about 8,000 cars total. That's all it was, you know, when the old man was running the company, right?
Right.
Well, if you consider that they owned 139 of those, that amounts to just under 2% of the entire Bugatti production ever. I mean, not including, you know, the modern Veyron or anything like that.
Right.
But of the original classic historic Bugatti production, just under 2% of all Bugattis produced are in this museum.
He wasn't going to stop either. Yeah. He really wasn't.
Amazing.
So I'm so glad you brought that number up, because that's a statistic that I wanted to quote and forgot.
That's all right. You got something more interesting to lead into here, right? Because there's a dark twist to this one.
Yes, sir. This is our one more thing, and perhaps one of the darker one more things we've done on this show.
One more thing.
So John Shakespeare, the son of William Shakespeare, founder of the Shakespeare Tackle Company, was found murdered in his residence. He was still living in Centralia in 1975. There were a lot of valuables left behind.
Yeah.
So people couldn't tell if it was robbery. The murder remains unsolved today, but I delved into some of my conspiracy forum places to get a closer look at this.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm.
What'd you find?
Well, interestingly enough, I didn't find who did it, spoiler alert, but interestingly enough, I found some people from Centralia saying that there was a cover-up afoot with the participation of the police department. John Shakespeare had gold coins in a false fan duct in the basement of the house where he was found murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Those coins weren't disturbed, but different pieces of evidence from the investigation began to disappear. And you can find people saying that they were shut down when they asked about it. Someone saying that they were a former employee of the Centralia Police Department. And
And this isn't an accident either. This is not like, you know, something that's being misconstrued as being a homicide or anything, because I was digging into this a little bit as well. I read in a in the May 9th, 1975 edition of the Southern Illinois newspaper that he was bound, handcuffed. I mean, he had major head trauma. They couldn't tell if he'd been shot or bludgeoned. It was a bad scene all around. I mean, but the house was not ransacked like you would think in a robbery, like you mentioned.
Right.
And there was no forcible entry into the home. So was this a friend of his, somebody that he knew, an acquaintance? What was going on? I mean, this is a, you know, a full 11 years after the deal went down, and everything was fine there between the two of them. And these guys were in, you know, the Schlumpf brothers, if you want to try to draw something out of that. They were in exile in Switzerland at the time. And, you know, it's just not possible that they were making a trip over to Illinois to do the deed. But I wonder what's going on, Ben. I mean, I wonder, did you find anything, any other connections maybe? That,
I found some tantalizing hints.
Really?
So, yeah, as of 2013, I found allegations that people in the town of Centralia know who the killer was and that the killer may still be alive.
Really?
And influential in the town, and they were
still alive.
Yeah, and they were, you know, these are all just speculative things from people from Centralia, apparently. But we have to keep in mind when we read stuff on forums that even if you see a picture, it could be photoshopped. You know, it's easy for people to make things up. However, from a couple different sources I found, it looks like people believe the murderer was a local. And that there was some sort of romantic relationship between the killer and Shakespeare. Apparently, one of the secrets that he had was that he may have been in a homosexual relationship.
All right. Well, I love intriguing small town murder tales like this. Now, this one involves a multimillionaire and, you know, the heir to the Shakespeare fishing tackle fortune. And it's just,
right.
It's an incredible
clearly
story.
Murdered.
And somebody who was active in the community. I mean, he was, as far as active, I mean, he did a lot. I mean, he was a sports racer. He, you know, the gentleman racer,
oil speculator.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, we mentioned he was a real estate guy as well. He owned a lot of real estate, and I don't know if it was all local in Centralia or where. You know, was it Centralia? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. You know how much. I guess how favored he was in the community. I don't know if he was somebody that was likable. I don't know if it's somebody that everybody kind of, you know, avoided.
There are some missing pieces, but clearly he was known there. And the my one issue with the accusation of a police force covering up something is that I read people saying that they were covering it up, but it's also possible that something can go wrong in an investigation that doesn't lead to a conviction, even if the officer are certain, even if the investigators are certain that they know the person, if they can't get the proof they need, then, you know, you have to play by the rules when you're the good guys. So it is possible that something went wrong and they do know the killer, or it's possible that the killer was just never found. And, the case, even if it was investigated again, would lead to the same results. However, a lot of the people I was reading were saying that they thought it was a cover-up.
Ah, yes. And you know what? They also have pointed to the fact that, you know, the sciences have advanced so much from 1975 to now that even some of the old evidence may yield some clues that would tie certain people to that murder if they were to reopen the case. And that's an interesting angle as well. We see that a lot in, you know, the true crime books that we read.
Right.
So, you know, it's very intriguing. I'm interested in this whole thing, and I wonder if they're ever going to reopen it or if it's just going to remain on the books as unsolved.
Yeah. You know, we will have to keep our eye on it and update you guys when we hear more. But as of now, that stuff I was reading was 2013. I haven't seen any movement on it yet.
That's pretty recent considering it's a 1975 murder.
It's almost exactly a year to the day since, maybe we will see some more in the future, but let us know what you think about that. Now, we want to go on record here and say that we do not believe the murder was related to the Bugattis because of the timeline.
No, absolutely. I don't believe
that. It's just
that at
an
all.
Interesting twist. And as true crime fans, we want to ask you guys if you had ever heard of this or if you had any ideas.
And it's fascinating that, you know, that out of this whole thing, I mean, the brothers ended up in exile in Switzerland and, you know, not doing so well towards the end, even though they were at the top of, you know, top of their game, top of the world there for a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, also, you know, Shakespeare, he met a bad end as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, even Ettore Bugatti.
Nice.
Yeah, I did it again. But yeah. I told you I wouldn't do it, but I did. you know, even the end of that corporation, it wasn't all that happy. There were some bad times there as well. So, yeah, it just seems like all the characters in this suffered a cruel fate.
Yeah, it's like a Grecian tragedy or something.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, you just keep digging and digging and it just gets worse and worse. But interesting story. And honestly, if you ever look up, you know, a trainload of Bugattis or the Schlumpf collection, you're going to see, you know, the current collection. But check out those photos of, you know, the Bugattis on the train as they're being loaded on, you know, on Shakespeare's property as they're headed down to New Orleans. And it's fantastic photos, really interesting. Not many of them, but the ones that are there, it's just incredible to see them all in one place like that.
And I think it's incredible that we have made this a one-part podcast. So you guys, we thought it was going to have to be a two-parter.
Yeah, you know what? There wasn't a great place to break in this one.
No, it's all one story. And plus, yeah. It's so exciting. I know we went a little over our time. I mean, we got to get out of here, buddy. Oh,
and as usual, there's about 20 things that I need to include that we didn't. So yeah. So maybe that'll show up on a Nuts and Bolts. Who knows?
Yes, and let us know what you thought about this story. If you have something to help illuminate our understanding of the Bugattis themselves, if you've been to the museum, which would be amazing, we'd like to hear about it. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter, where we do read everything. And it takes us a while to write back sometimes, but we're doing our best. If we ever build up too much of a backlog, we'll have a listener mail episode.
That's what we do.
And you can check out all of our podcasts, including some we specifically mentioned, on our website, carstuffshow.com. If you want to cut around the social media rigmarole, look, we get it. We have an email address just for you. It is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.